You're listening to WWBC, Cocoa, Melbourne, Titusville, 1510 AM, as well as W234BI, Cocoa, Rockledge, and W264AS, Rockledge, Melbourne, Palm Bay, and 100.7 FM.
Hello, Space and Treasure Coast. This is Sita Begee on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends right here in very sunny Cocoa, Florida. We are heard on AM 1510 WWBC, FM 94.7, 99.9, 100.7, and online everywhere on God's magnificent planet.
That's
and I
right.
have to say that because I love to wake up every day and say, thank God I'm alive.
Me too. Me too, absolutely. And happy fall. Happy first day of fall, y'all. And happy first day. I think it starts at 6 p.m. tonight, but happy Rosh Hashanah to all of our Jewish family and friends that are out there. Of course, you can hear us live here on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends on www.1510wwbc.com. Hit that Lesson Live button and get us on any one of your streaming devices. And then, of course, also on that same website, the 1510WWBC, you can get all of our archive shows. You look it up under Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. We're on 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time each and every Monday. And then, of course, we share it on all of our social media, Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, and on our website, which is SitaMediaInc.com, all downloadable. We had a whopping 21,000 downloads last week, Sita.
Woohoo!
I don't know where everyone comes from, but I would say 80% of them, from my statistics, 80% of them are from the United States.
Okay, praise the
Lord. So that's awesome.
That.
Yes, Chicago, all the places you lived, actually.
Yeah, I hate to sound churchy, but praise the Lord.
Yeah.
So for our listeners who are tuning into Viewpoint with Sita and Friends for the first time, we have been on air here in Cocoa, Florida for almost 15 years. And we give people a platform, whether they want to talk about financial literacy, they're advocates for clean air, clean water, maybe clean sunshine, like we had the solar people call in last week. We give folks a platform to talk about politics, running for office, writing a book, selling a book, marketing a book, whatever it is you want to talk. We have people that open businesses. We have mortgage companies, the bankers. We've had a lot of nonprofits, and thank you to all our sponsors that help us to stay on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends here on WWBC. We're able to, I can't say pay our station, but we like to make sure that our station is compensated for the time that we sit in this studio. Danny's got to get paid. Kim, our owner of our station, is very pleased with us. The FCC is very pleased with us. And so Danny here just told us he would like us to stay on for 2 more years.
There we go.
And there he goes.
Gauntlet has been thrown.
Yeehaw. So we're not sure yet. We have to try to see if we can make it through 2026, which we will. So today's no different on our show. Ellen O'Neill is here. She is my right hand for the show. I could not do Viewpoint with Sita and Friends without Ellen O'Neill. Thank you, Miss Ellen.
Thank you. Thank you for a great 15 years together. Imagine all of that starting on the paper napkin at that little restaurant right
That's
down
right.
by your house.
That's
remember?
Right. That's
the first
right.
day we met. And
right outside Tortoise Island.
Right. And thank you again to Mike Everett for the awesome introduction.
Right. And Allie's here, Allie Tamber, who comes every Monday and sits with us. She's our cheerleader on the show. And we have another cheerleader that's going to be frequently visiting, Maggie Hickson. Thank you, Maggie. Maggie's my good friend, my ABWA sister. And it's amazing. She can kind of finish my sentences. We think so alike. And I love friends like that, that you don't have to worry about what you say because they know what you say is coming from your heart. And so, Ellen, our friend, Mr. Art Rubin, is on the phone with Eleanor Cooney. They're calling in to speak about the book Ivy Hill, a novel that's inspired by really true events in his life. And it resonates with so many of us, the life that he had with bullying and losing a father and living through the war and living through some relatives that you really don't want in your life, but they're there to stay. And then our second segment, I have an Indian-American guy, Mr. Sunil Kumar, who I met a long time ago on the website Desi Blue, which means blue as in Desi Indian and then blue as in Democrats/independents, you know, whatever. He's going to call in and talk about the contributions of Indian Americans to the United States socially, politically, emotionally, spiritually. So I think it's going to be a really good show. And on that happy note, we're going to talk to our good friend. I almost said Eddie because Eddie's on my mind. It's a good thing I didn't say Irwin. No,
that's okay.
But we're going to talk to our good friend, Arthur Rubin, who's on the phone. Art, thank you for being part of our show, Believing in Viewpoint with Seed and Friends, and calling in today. So tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, because your bio is extensive, and I'd prefer you just to tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in writing the book.
Well, first of all, thank you for having us back. We really appreciate it. I was born in Brooklyn, New York in 1952. After my father's death in 1957, my mother remarried, who was basically the protagonist of the story. And 8 months later, we moved to Newark, New Jersey, away from four generations of family, all of my friends, and wound up living with this guy who turned out to be an absolute monster. And the book is primarily about what transpired between he and I over the next 12 years with the Ivy Hill neighborhood, community, schools, sports, all of that being a backdrop. Life-wise, I've been married to the same woman for almost 45 years. We have three children, two of whom are in show business, and five grandchildren. I have a master's in social work from Catholic University in D.C., a joint master's in business and public finance from American University, and I was a certified financial planner for many decades, retiring 5 years ago, at which point I met up with Eleanor through a mutual friend of theirs and my son's, and we wound up collaborating on a book that's largely about my life. I'd say it's 70% true, 30% and flat out BS, but it's definitely
creative, not true events of my life. Sometimes you need to fill in a book with a little bit of the BS to make it more appealing, right? You know,
absolutely. And
you have to, otherwise it wouldn't be on the a bestseller, which your book is a bestseller. Ivy Hill became one of the Amazon best-selling books.
Yeah, within 11 weeks of the time it came out,
wow,
the book was in the top 10 in its category for over a week. In fact, for a few days, we were ahead of one of Danielle Steele's books, which was pretty remarkable because, yeah, I'm a first-time author, and really, you know, without Eleanor's help, I wouldn't have really known what I was doing. But she's a multi-published author with a lot of skill, and we put our two heads together and came up with what we think was a really great story, and it's been a lot of fun.
Is Eleanor on this call with you? I thought you were trying to conference call with her.
She was supposed to call in at 103, as was I. So
not call a separate line though. She was supposed to call you.
Yeah,
you were supposed to conference.
Eleanor and I have never met. We live 3,000 miles apart.
So I was just going to say, I remember that part of the story,
you know,
about your details was that you guys had never met. How did you meet?
I asked my son, who's a Hollywood director and who went to acting school in New York, if he could help me find an editor. And he wound up asking around in his class and came up with someone who turned out to be a friend of Eleanor's. So my son had never met Eleanor either, but Eleanor was recommended by this classmate of my son's, and that's you know, how we wound up meeting. I called Eleanor. We had a couple of long conversations. She sent me some examples, or samples rather, of her work, referred me to two books she had written, which were terrific. And when we spoke on the phone, we just really hit it off. We're both about the same age. We're in our mid-70s. We had a lot of similar childhood experiences.
Hey, Arthur, I'm wondering, Eleanor is trying to call our station, and our station has one line coming in. Is there any way you could give her my cell phone number, and she can call in on my phone, and we'll hold her up to our speaker?
Sure.
Okay, I will email you my cell phone number right now. Will that work?
Yeah, sure. I'll call her on a different line as well then.
Yes, because otherwise we won't be able to get her on the show, and we would like to let her call my cell phone.
The other thing, I could hang up and you can call me back. Would that work?
No, we would waste too much precious time. So just go ahead and text her if you want, or call her on a different line. This is why we tell our listeners on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, our show is fun, it's unscripted, and everything happens in real life. I could hear
sure
a phone ringing away there. But, yeah, so if you could just email her, that would be good. Another thing is, you know, we were looking at your book, and I've been telling people to go ahead and buy this book, because everything that happened to you as a child is happening right now to so many families. We're watching so many families that are extended families or step families. And you had a very difficult time with your stepfather. Tell our listeners a little bit about how you overcame such trials and tribulations with him. Because I tell you, in today's world, somebody like Irwin, no woman would stay married to him.
There's a couple of aspects to that answer, but do you want me to try to get Eleanor first? Do you want me to?
No, go ahead and answer.
Okay. My mother listened to everything her father told her. And when my father died, my grandfather, who was a very tough guy, pretty much no give and take with him. He said, look, you're a 34-year-old woman with two children. How are you going to support yourself? You need a husband. So he went out and found Irwin. Thinking he was helping my mother. Irwin was a CPA. He was twice divorced. My grandfather knew his mother a little bit from the neighborhood in Brooklyn. And they brokered this arrangement, which is described in the book, where Irwin would marry my mother. My grandfather paid him, gave him money for a down payment for a house. And then Irwin pretty much stabbed them in the back by picking up the family and moving away from Brooklyn to Newark. And my grandfather was blindsided by that. But Eddie pretty much had to adapt to living with this 6'6" monster who had these two pinky rings, which he named Little Joe and Iron Mike, and he used to hold them up to Eddie with closed fists. Eddie's 6 years old, keep in mind, and this guy's like, looks like he's right out of the Addams Family. And he also would hit Eddie with a hanger, wooden hanger, belt buckles, you know, just basically tormented him. And as many bullied young boys do, they learn to adapt by internalizing a defense mechanism, which Anna Freud coined identification with the aggressor. In other words, they learn to emulate the bully's behavior by doing the same thing to other kids. And that's pretty much what happened to Eddie, I would say, starting at age 8 and continuing until two horrific incidents between ages 12 and 13, one of which was a brutal fight with a kid who stuttered, which Eddie just, for no reason, went after this kid. And then the other one, which would now be considered a hate crime, 12 or 13-year-old Eddie taunted a Holocaust survivor by making fun of him. And it wasn't until the Holocaust survivor's wife gave him a stare that to this day is still beyond vivid that Eddie finally got it, understood what he was doing, and just stopped it cold turkey. And interestingly enough, within the next 2 years, after a couple of other really bad incidents, none of which Eddie was involved as an aggressor, but was pretty much, I wouldn't say a victim of, but was devastated by, Eddie realized he had enormous empathic skills and was an excellent listener, and wound up developing what almost became a hobby of spending hours on the phone late into the evenings talking to his classmates about their problems at home, their problems in school, and giving out advice as a 14, 15-year-old kid, which probably led to him pursuing a degree in social work. And then,
which is really what you did. But your story is like David versus Goliath, in like Irwin being Goliath and you being David. Your book, I think, appealed to so many Americans because it is a story of good over evil, and that you triumphed in the end. You know, when I skimmed the book over again for the show, and I had forgotten what he did with that $1,200 check when you were supposed to get into a university. And I can't tell you the name. I want to call Irwin right now. And knowing that he's a live character that did this to you, where he put that check, and 7 years later they found that check when they went to move that refrigerator.
He really
wanted to sabotage your life, you know, and... It's so sad that you had to live through that. It's a shame that you were bullied in your own home by the man who your grandfather, Sam, thought would be a protector for your mother and you and Jenny. So tell us a little bit about that incident. The phone keeps ringing off the hook. I know Eleanor is trying to call in, and I am so sorry we can't get her on. I thought she was going to conference in with you, and then both of you would call in, but...
Sent her 7 emails.
Yeah, so. Go ahead and talk to us a little bit about how you felt about this betrayal by your stepfather.
In context of everything that transpired between us, that incident was far less significant than some of the other things that he did, the worst of which was the summer job he got Eddie at the Newark Housing Project called Hayes Homes, where Irwin was telling Eddie he needed to earn money for college, whereas in reality, Irwin had stolen all of the money that had been saved and earned by Eddie through band jobs and camp counselor jobs and everything else.
And your bar mitzvah money, too.
The bar mitzvah money was the largest.
That's scoundrel.
Some of that.
You know?
Irwin had used all that money for gambling and then tells Eddie he needs to pay for the first semester of college, and the best way to do that was to take this very high-paying job working for the city of Newark as a custodian at a housing project where it was just 3 years after the Newark riots, and it was not expected that, I don't know how else to say this, that a white kid would get out of there alive.
But he knew that. It's almost like he was planning that you would die, and he would then cash in on an insurance policy on you.
He,
you know, gamblers do these things. And he
was not only doing that, Sita, but he had heard that someone else had won a $1 million lawsuit against the city of Newark for some sort of negligence or an accident on a work site. And he was planning that Eddie would be killed on the job, and he, the grieving parent, would then sue the city and, you know, would fix all of his gambling debts. He wouldn't have to help out with college he would be set for life. So he was willing to trade Eddie after all else had failed. He was going to trade Eddie's life for a lump sum payment. And in context with that, what he did with the tuition check or the deposit for tuition was really a small thing. I mean, you know, I know that sounds crazy, but it was not something that I would say in the context of everything else he had done was that big of a deal. It's horrific for a normal person to hear about that they would sabotage
him planning to cash in on your demise. My goodness.
Of course.
But, you know, your story tells the readers so much about your mom being a surviving parent and all the stuff that comes with that, the heartache, losing the love of her life, having to raise you and Jenny, knowing that it's not going to be perfect. And she really tried so hard, which in today's world, there are so many single moms that are in that exact same situation.
No question.
And you know, that brings about depression. It brings about, you know, your mom, there were days when she didn't even want to wake up, but she had to rise and shine, and she had to get involved with you and Jenny and taking you to school and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to us a little bit about your mom and how horrific it was knowing that her own dad pretty much sold her out.
My mother, whose character in the book is Marcy, was a very effervescent, lively, engaging character when my father was alive. After his death, she never recovered. She had no affect. She, you know, spent a lot of time by herself. You know, didn't really pursue a whole lot of hobbies. You know, was just like gone. I mean, she was not helpful. She was my mother, but she wasn't my mother.
Because you pretty much raised yourself.
No question.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when a young kid raises themselves, they don't make good decisions. They don't know how to ask for help. And in Eddie's case, what he decided to do was pursue getting laughs in school, because he needed that attention and feeling of being wanted. So rather than try to get the best possible grades, the goal was to get the most possible laughs. And some of that in-school behavior became reckless, dangerous, whatever you want to call it. By eighth grade, he was turning in profanity-laced homework just to see if he could get away with it by targeting which teachers he thought were not reading the homework.
Well, that was that was Eddie's coping mechanism. And
yes.
A lot of kids, they do that in school, you know, in order to cope, to become extremely funny and all that. But I think we were finally able to get Eleanor Cooney on. So Eleanor, thank you for taking the time to call in on Viewpoint with Seed and Friends. And you collaborated on this book, Ivy Hill, with our very good friend, Arthur Rubin, which God knows we're so... I am grateful to God that he's alive, considering what he went through. But
not as grateful as I am.
But I mean, I just want to hold that Oren, and you know what? But the thing is, Eleanor, what I want to know from you is, you wrote the book in a time period when the country, the United States, was going through so much as well. You had the riots in Newark, New Jersey. You had President Kennedy was assassinated. And you also had the Vietnam War. So with all of that going on, here you have Eddie trying to survive in a household, losing his beloved dad. And then you have Eddie, who was monstrous to him. How did you fit all that into the book, where the reader says, boy, this is really taking me back to a time when, you know, America was different?
Well, I think Eddie's first awareness of the big world out there and how bad it could be was with the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And that happened in November of 63. And then things happened in rapid succession after that. In 64, along came the Beatles, and the Beatles turned Eddie on hugely. I mean, it was And I was there. I was a young person when that happened. It was an absolute explosion of excitement and novelty. This wave of it was this thrilling wave of excitement swept over the country. Then a few years later, the hippie movement was going, and there was a Summer of Love, 1967. So by then, Eddie's still not quite old enough to participate, but he knows it's going on, and he thinks it's pretty cool. He reads about it in the paper and thinks, you know, I wouldn't mind slipping around in the mud and listening to music and having fun like that. And then July of 67, same summer as the Summer of Love, the Newark riots. And actually, we should call it the Newark Uprising, because that's what people who were uprising called it. And Eddie, by then, was 15, and he, as you know, got right into the middle of it unintentionally. He was on the trail of a girl who lived on the other side of town, and he went right through the riots. And
that's how the book starts.
Yes. But you know, Eleanor, one of the things that the recurring theme in the book is that Eddie was able to fit in with people from all walks of life. Eddie was able to fit in with the kids who had socioeconomic issues, and Eddie, his mentor, the person that guided him, ended up being this black guy, Bobby J.
Yeah.
Bobby J, the former New York high school football star. And, you know, this book makes you think about even Bobby, how he ended up not pursuing his career because of drugs. The book actually shows you the need for young men to have guidance. And, Eleanor, as you read it, did you feel like Bobby came in a time when Eddie needed a father figure?
Well, it wasn't so much that he was a father figure, but a voice that penetrated Eddie's oblivion somewhat. He and Bobby J had been working together, doing very hard work at the project at Hayes Homes. And at the end of that first day of work, Bobby J sits down with Eddie, and he's really impressed by how this young white kid worked that day. He's seriously impressed. And they have a conversation. And that's when Bobby J learns about Irwin, and Bobby J says, you know, your pops is trying to kill you. In other words, he sent you out here to Hayes Homes hoping that you would get murdered. And Eddie does not believe it.
Right.
But Bobby J insists. He says, come on, man. You know.
Yeah, because it just didn't fit in. It just didn't make sense that such a young kid would go to work there. And for what reason?
Well, he wasn't that young. How old were you, Art? You were, what, 16?
16. In today's world, they're playing video games at home at 16.
I was actually 18. No. I was out of high school. It was the summer between high school and college.
That's right. So you were 18.
So I was 18.
Yeah. So we have like 3 minutes left of the segment, Art, and I want you to tell us a little bit about where we can find this book. And also, we're all thinking in the studio, who would play in the movie of your life? Like, who would play Bobby, and who would play Irwin, and who would play Marcy and Jenny? And so tell us where the book can be found, and then let's talk a little bit about, this is a really good story, because it has every element of what's happening in our nation and in society.
Well, first of all, the best price for the book is on Amazon. It's the paperback is somewhere in the $14 to $16 range. It's also available on Amazon Kindle for, I think it's $7.99 is the last price that I've seen. As for who would play it in a TV series or a movie, my original fantasy, although he's too old now, is that Brad Garrity would play Irwin. Because they're both about the same height, and Brad Garrity, although he's mostly a comedian, could also give you a really scary look.
Yeah.
But I think he's probably, you know, close to 70 at this point. Richard Dreyfuss actually looks very much like my grandfather. They're the same size.
Sam.
They're from the same.
Yeah.
They're from the same Austria-Hungary, part of the world. They both ended up in Brooklyn, and there's really just a striking resemblance there. Haven't really.
How about Eddie's mom? How about Erwin's mother? Who would play her?
Rhoda.
Rhoda.
We'll have to figure that out. But, I just want to tell both of you, you and Eleanor, that this book is about strength. It's about resilience and overcoming so much trials and tribulations, that both of you did such an awesome job. Because one book in my life that I read straight through, and I think I just took a break just to eat something and go right back to it. But with the remaining a minute or so, I would just like for Art to tell us a little bit about Ivy Hill.
Sure.
Tell me a little bit, if you can, in 30 seconds or so, about that apartment complex.
Ivy Hill is a small community in the far western corner of Newark, New Jersey. It borders on the suburban community of South Orange, the suburban community of Maplewood, and the urban community of Irvington. The Ivy Hill Apartments is the largest privately owned housing complex in New Jersey, with 10,000 residents. It's 10, 15-story buildings with people from 40 different countries, and it comprises more than half of the Ivy Hill community. At the time that Eddie lived there, 1958 to 1970, it was a lower middle class, blue-collar community. A lot of Eddie's classmates' fathers were policemen, firemen, tradesmen. Some of them had been in the military. The single-family homes were mostly two-family on tiny lots. Over the years, the Ivy Hill neighborhood deteriorated quite a bit and became quite dangerous. And as of 2012, while it only comprised 3% of the population of Newark, it was responsible for 10% of the crime. And fortunately, now it's back on the upswing a little bit. It got its own police station, and the schools have improved a little bit. It's got a long way to go, but the last time I drove through there, it was definitely looking better.
Well, that's good.
People were fixing up their houses and stuff.
I have to tell you and Eleanor that as the reader reads this book, we all see that Erwin had... He had no lack of remorse. He had no empathy. He had the inability to apologize. He lied a lot. He bullied people. And so in today's world, you would agree, I guess, like I said to myself, that there's so many people in our world today like that, that are such characters. What do you think? What can we do to help the United States, our world, that people do become more empathetic, more kind, be respectful, that if a child loses a father, you don't have to be that bully of a stepfather, because every life is precious, every child is precious, and if you could afford to help that mother, why be so nasty and mean like Erwin was? What can in a minute or two, we'll give each of you a chance to respond, each of you have a minute, and then we have to go to the second guest.
I can best respond as a former mental health practitioner. Erwin was clearly a psychopath. So you can't teach a psychopath empathy, because, that part of their brain to develop empathy probably doesn't exist. I mean, I'm not a psychiatrist, and I can't say that for sure, but from everything I've read, somebody with narcissistic personality disorder, a psychopath, a sociopath, doesn't have the capacity for empathy, doesn't have the capacity to apologize, doesn't have...
We'll let Eleanor respond for 30 seconds, and then we have got to go to second segment.
Sure.
Go ahead. Eleanor, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
To play Rhoda, Kathy Bates. Okay.
Yes.
And
Yeah,
I'm not very optimistic about the human race.
I would say Meryl Streep could play Rhoda.
She could, yeah, she could play anybody. You know, but Kathy
Bates, she could play anybody.
She's got the right shape.
Well, I tell you. All right, so Eleanor, we've got our second guest calling in right now. So for our listeners who are tuned in, we will be right back with Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. We've got Mr. Sunil on the phone, and we'll talk to you in a bit. Danny, take it away.
Cloud 9 Mattress and Furniture is a family-owned furniture dealer featuring the best and most affordable brands. They offer all servicing for free. The delivery, setup, and home, removal of old furniture, and warranty. Work with a reputable and experienced local business as they strive for excellence with their customers. Scotty's been in the mattress and furniture business for 32 years. You can shop online, call, or stop into the showroom to place an order. They are conveniently located inside the Merritt Square Mall and service all of Brevard County in Central Florida. Super savings sale happening now. That's Cloud 9 Mattress and Furniture, 321-459-2473. Visit them on the web at Cloud9, that's Cloud number 9, furniture.com. Again, 321-459-2473 for Cloud 9 Mattress and Furniture. Located in Titusville, Florida, Dixie Crossroads Jotkoff has Financial been Group great. Is a certified public accountant.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Sita Begee on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. This is our second part of the show. We had a robust first segment with our friend Mr. Arthur Rubin, with Eleanor Cooney. They spoke about the book Ivy Hill. We are heard on AM 1510, WWBC, FM 94.7, 99.9, 100.7, and all over God's magnificent planet where people can log on, Miss Ellen.
That's right, 1510wwbc.com. You can hit that listen live button and get us on any one of your streaming devices. And then, of course, we archive all the shows there as well under the on-demand button. You pick any Monday. And then, of course, on our website and on our social media, cdmediainc.com, we, of course, not only download and have all of the shows available, but then we're also findable, so you can find them by topic or by guest name. So, and once again, Sita, fabulous, fabulous first half of the show.
Yeah, you know what? It is what it is. We do the best we can on our show.
We did great. Yeah, it was great.
So, for friends who are tuning in, my friend, Ms. Sunil, is on the phone. And we met through politics, I have to say, right, Sunil? And he is the co-founder of Daisy Blue. And if you could kindly talk to us a little bit about your bio is so extensive. So talk to us a little bit about yourself and you're a native of Mumbai, India. You have an engineering degree. You moved to the United States in 1980. And ever since then, you never were involved in politics alone, but you saw the need to co-find Daisy Blue. So talk to us a little bit about Daisy Blue, the group that's dedicated to moderate politics, I might say. And then you also journeyed into some activism. So go ahead. Talk to us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. So thank you, Sita, for that kind intro. My organization, the organization I co-founded, Daisy Blue, actually the words are spelled like the English words, Daisy Blue. It's a play on words. And as most of your listeners would know, Daisy means somebody from the Indian subcontinent or South Asian. So you're absolutely right. Until around 2016, 2017, I was very focused on my career in Silicon Valley, happy, you know, to be completely out of politics, although I did follow it closely as an observer. But then, and you know, a lot of my friends, I said, I want to stay away from politics. So then the election of 2016 happened, and then things in the country started to change in a direction I didn't like, and they were getting worse and worse. So then I realized that I may want to stay away from politics, but politics is not going to stay away from me, because everything, you know.
Well, life affects, is politics, right? From the minute you're...
Life, yeah.
Well, you know, I try... When people tell me I stay away from politics, this is what I say to them. I say, look it. From the minute you're born, the formula that they put in that little bag for your mom, the diaper, the brands, the brand of that diaper, the brand of that formula, the ointment that they put on your bottom because you might get red, you know, you from diaper rash, the bottle that you use, it's all politics. And the day that you leave God's magnificent planet, whether you're going to be cremated or whether you're going to be buried, the type of casket they put you in, the type of box, the type of wood, where did that wood come from? The funeral home, who owns it, who profits from it, the chairs in the funeral home, the person saying your prayer, every single thing. Life is politics, whether people believe it or not.
Absolutely, yeah. So that's what I realized, you know, and that's why we started this organization, to educate our fellow South Asians. So as you know, and your listeners know, South Asians are the fastest growing community in the U.S. And they're also, you know, among the most successful. But, you know, they generally are not politically engaged. So the reason we started this organization is to educate them about the issues and why it's important, why voting is important. So that's basically what we are. You know, we are a group of South Asians, and we reach out to our fellow South Asians to educate them and help them make decisions about politics.
Well, and you know, in the political climate that we have today in the United States, a lot of immigrants who had assimilated and were voting and, you know, had their businesses and they were doing quite well, a lot of people, Sunil, even in the group They See Blue, they're no longer active because people are afraid of denaturalization. And and sadly, I just spoke with a physician and his wife. They're both retired. They're both in their 80s. And he said, this is why we never got involved in politics, because we leave our home countries and we come to the United States to work, to build, to give back. And we are now scared to get involved at this age. And even a lot of Iranian Americans, this is why a lot of people didn't show up to protest rallies, didn't show up to hold signs for, you know, whatever was going on, clean water, clean air, Planned Parenthood, whatever. What do you say to that, that people are saying, well, this was one of the reasons that they didn't get involved and it had materialized now to truth?
So I think we cannot allow fear to rule our lives, I would say. And that's my first point. We have to, you know, every time we get in a car and drive, there's a danger that, you know, there'll be an accident, but we don't, you know, stop driving. So now I think we are in a situation where the problem is not going to solve itself. And if people don't, and getting involved can have different, you know, there are different ways. One important ways is to vote, okay? And to educate people about, you know, whom to vote for. And that, I don't think, I mean, that is a highly protected part of the, you know, U.S. Constitution. So we absolutely can do that. So I just wanted to say that our group is an all-volunteer group. We are a grassroots organization. So we don't, you know, have candidates running for office. We have no other interest other than to, you know, basically
get out the vote.
Yeah, and also to help our country, the country that we immigrated to, that we all, you know, love and cherish. So we want the country to be more like it was when we immigrated here. So you can say that's kind of the high-level goal of what we are trying to do. And the way we get there is by voting the right way and also by educating our fellow citizens, mainly South Asians in our case, to vote the right way, you know. So that's kind of
for a listener, his name is Sunil Mehta, M-E-H-T-A. So, you know, you've worked for so long in the United States, and over your 40-year career in the semiconductor industry, you held both technical and management roles. accumulating 18 publications and 92 U.S. patents. You are an amazing human being. Thank you. I'm grateful to know you, your existence on the planet, that I'm here. You're amazing, and I'm so grateful that you're taking the time to love the country that we immigrated to, that I love myself. And you said that so eloquently, that all of us should be trying to get the country back on track.
Thank you. Yeah.
So go ahead.
The South Asians have contributed. It's not just that we love our country, but we have contributed so much to its success, especially in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, I know. My brother reminds me constantly of that, of who's the head of Google, who's the head of Clinique, who's the head
of Microsoft.
And it's like on an everyday basis, he'll send me, look at these Indians, you know, and I love it but I think it's because of the guidance and the upbringing that we had as children as well. You know, we all of us come from parents that wanted us to do well in life. And that's why in our first segment, when the gentleman almost didn't get to go to college, it hurt my heart, because that's one thing that we all promote is trade, commerce, going to college, opening a business, whatever. But I want you to talk a little bit about, in addition to you getting involved and getting people to vote, wouldn't you say that the way to get this accomplished is for people to talk about issues that affect mm-hmm. them on a daily basis, 24/7, 365 days a year, things like climate change and healthcare and science and world affairs and income inequality, immigration reform? Wouldn't you say it's not a one-day shopping thing? This has to be discussions that you have at home all the time.
Absolutely. So these issues, you know, and also I just want to say something kind of which may be surprising. So when I said I wasn't into politics, I was also, I did not really vote one way or the other. I was a very proud independent, and I believed that certain things that the Democrats did were good, and certain things the Republicans did were good. So I went back and forth. But after the election of 2016, all the issues that you named, you know, each and every issue, okay, whether it's science, education, healthcare, climate change, income inequality, immigration, the party, you know, the Republican Party is on the wrong side of that issue on each and every one of them. So that made my decision very easy. And I registered as a Democrat for the first time in my life, and I've never regretted that. So I think the other point I want to make is that politics is intruding in ways that we never imagined, for South Asians. So, for example, now we are, you know, there's a lot of harassment that is happening. And as you said, people are afraid, right? For the first time, when people, you know, go out of the country, a lot of them are so paranoid that they erase a lot of their social media kind of, you know, groups and all that, because they are so afraid. And this is like, imagine, this is like almost like a police state, right?
Yes.
So, and the second thing is the relationship with India, okay, that the largest democracy in the world, and we are the oldest democracy in the world, was always very, it was never perfect, but it was always good, with a kind of sense of mutual, you know, respect and admiration. That has gone by the wayside too now. You know, India is being portrayed by the current administration as literally kind of a, I forget the word that he, you know, that was used, an economy that's like a basket economy, you know. I mean, it's like, and on top of that, you know, all these tariffs of 50% have been imposed on a friendly country, which is a, you know, another democracy. So both from the standpoint of people, of South Asians in this country, and even the Indians living in India, everybody is impacted. So this is a person of politics intruding in your life, whether you like it or not.
Well,
so you have no choice.
I agree with you, because I know people who had trips that they were going to go abroad, and they decided that they're not going to go. They canceled. I know people that are travel agents and work on cruise ships that they're no longer traveling, because It's almost like doom and gloom. People are afraid to come back into the airport and being asked a lot of questions. But I tend to say I'm brave and I'm courageous enough to say when I leave the country, I'm going to be coming back, because I have given my very best to the United States. I have worked. Absolutely. My family has worked. We've contributed. We have assimilated. We encourage innovation and we encourage education. We encourage, you know, we help people. And I think Indians, when we show our power that way, I think we are going to be okay, because this is not the first time that Indians are being attacked, you know, in that way. I mean, look at what happened mm-hmm. under the British. You know, we've all seen the Mahabharata and all these movies. And that brings me to another point. You are a movie buff. So where is Shah Rukh Khan when you need him to say, hey, stop treating Indians like this, right? I would like Shah Rukh to say something.
Like yeah,
you know,
exactly.
because everybody knows who is. So tell me a little bit. You're a movie buff, and like me, the Hindi songs of long ago, they pull at our heartstrings, because all the movies back then was about good over evil. All of them was David against Goliath. And in between, you had a few love songs and people running around a coconut tree and this and that. But it always showed you that someone would rise from nothing and by the grace of God, believing in Bhagwan, and yet you would become something because your heart was pure. So do you still feel like that's how we grew up?
I think that idealistic view is still there inside us, but because of the, you know, heavy bombardment we are getting constantly from different sources, like social media and other channels, I think that ideology is being shaken. And I think one of the things that is happening also is that there's no absolute source of truth anymore for people, which is kind of a weird thing to say. Because in the early days that you're describing, there were certain sources of truth, like the newspapers, for example, which everybody trusted. But right now, because of, you know, the newspaper industry is become an endangered industry, and then it's been replaced by, you know, the online sources and social media and all that kind of stuff. So if you're getting your news from those sources, it's going to be very skewed. And then your whole worldview is going to be very skewed. And your values are going to be shaken. So I think those values are inside, the good values are inside everybody. I believe that strongly. But people's actions and people's views on what's going on and what to do about it have been heavily colored by what they read. So, you know, that's kind of the reality. And someone like Shah Rukh Khan or someone like that, we need someone to come in and kind of wake people up, you know, somebody who can communicate in a clear way.
Mr. Sunil Mehta, and for our listeners who are tuning in, we're speaking with the co-founder of the Desi Blue, which is a group dedicated to leveraging the cultural contributions of Indian Americans here in the United States and worldwide, and basically to get people out to vote and vote their conscience. And so, you know, as I talk to you, one of the things I like to say, and my friend Ellen and Allie and Maggie, who's at the studio, we all agree that we want to leave a good footprint behind for the next generation. And the only way to do that is to absolutely speak truth to power. And you're right about the publications and the magazines. We see, not just here, but all over the world, where the corporations who own these TV stations, who own the newspapers, who own the magazines, the bottom line is only about their money. How much? Yeah. I mean, we see political pundits on certain news organizations that have nothing to their name except they can blah, blah, blah and say something, and they get paid to go and lie and say things that people just want to hear. For example, we have Medicaid expansion here in the state of Florida that is under attack. And a lot of people who can write a check for health insurance. Some of them get insurance through their employer, and some are on the poverty level or that certain level where they can get Medicaid. But what about the people that fall in between the gap? Someone who opens a business and is barely making it, they want that Obamacare, which is the Affordable Care Act. But we see that is under attack, and we see Medicaid expansion. So when you talk to people and you say, hey, before you listen to certain news channels about giving away stuff, think about your own life and what's going on in your household. Am I correct?
Absolutely. That's very well said, you know, that you I think ultimately it comes down to what values do you believe in, right? And you mentioned a very important value, which is giving back, right? Because a lot of South Asians have done very well, and in most cases they don't really need to make a lot more money for their life to be impacted in a meaningful way. But one thing that can make them much happier is giving back and making life better for others. But that thinking, like I said, has fallen deep below the surface. And right now people are like being carried away. So I think the other important point you mentioned is that outrage sells, right? You mentioned all these vested interests and corporate interests. The more you outrage people, the more they're going to stay connected and want to, you know, listen to you, because they're so afraid. You're stoking fear and outrage, right?
Yeah.
And the fear is misplaced in many cases, because the immigrants are invading our country. The crime is increasing. All of those things are absolutely false. Immigrants are not invading a country, and the immigrants who are coming are actually contributing to our country much more than they're taking back, right?
Yeah.
And crime is not increasing in our cities. It's actually going down. The statistics say it's
right.
Going
and
down.
The truth is, so, most Americans, most Indian people I know, Indian Americans, we do encourage legal immigration. I don't know one immigrant or one Indian or one American that says, hey, you should come here illegally and you'll get... I don't know anybody that's... I hear people say, if you come to the United States on a vacation, you better find yourself on that aircraft on time. I hear people say, don't come to the United States and take stuff from people that you didn't work for if you come and come legally. I've never in my whole 60 years of age heard anybody say, hey, it's time for you to go there illegally. Or go to Spain illegally, or go to... So, all, like you say, we have to stop it. But we've got 2 minutes left, and I know that you're currently working on a novel that tells a fictional story about three transformational figures in science and technology, which is right up your alley: Albert Einstein, Robert Noyce, and Steve Jobs, which I really appreciated Steve Jobs. So tell us a little bit quickly, if you can, in a minute or less, about that. And you also wrote a book called A Compass. So, yeah. So talk to us quickly about your writing skills.
Yeah. Actually, that's the same book I'm working on, The Compass.
Okay.
So it's about the three figures you mentioned. And two of them, I'm sure, are very well known to your listeners, Albert Einstein and Steve Jobs. But the middle one, Robert Noyce, he used to be a legend in Silicon Valley, because he is basically considered the father of Silicon Valley by the people in the early days, you know, Silicon Valley. But he's a forgotten figure now. So the reason I wrote the book is I read the biographies of all these people and I was fascinated. But those biographies are big, like tomes, you know, which most people wouldn't read. So I wanted to bring their story to, a larger number of readers in a relatable way. So basically, I've fictionalized their life story, where I basically written it, you know, like in real time is happening in their life. But it's also got a time travel device, which is where the compass comes in, where a group of four gifted teenagers, they find a way to basically visit the past and observe the lives of these three people as it's unfolding while they're making their greatest accomplishment. So that's what the book is about.
Well, thank you so much. You're an amazing human being, and I'm so proud to know you. And you're absolutely correct. I think we cannot tell people which way to vote, but what we can tell them is, if you go to bed at night and you have food in your refrigerator, you should want that for everybody else. If you go to the doctor and you have insurance, you should want that for everybody else. And if you have a job, you should want people to have work. If you give back to the United States and pay your taxes and you have good roads and good law enforcement and you have, you know, people at the postal service, you have the military that get paid from taxes, you should also want that. And the only way we can do that is through education and opportunities. And that's what I hear from you. And that's what I love, because you took that and it made you somebody today.
Absolutely. That's correct. Yeah.
Another fantastic show. We will share all of your information on our websites, as well as our social media and so forth, of this great interview. Thanks again so much for tuning in to Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, here each and every Monday, 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on 1510 WWBC.
Thank you, Mr. Mehta.